Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this week's photo show. It's been a few weeks since we've had everyone together. Neil has joined us back, and we're looking forward to his comments about a surprise subject I want to bring up in a few minutes. Tonight we'll be talking about our news and gear, and we're going to talk about a topic tonight. We're going to look at about macro photography. I don't know whether you've ever tried any of that, but we've seemed to have three experts here on macro photography, especially mushrooms or fungi. So we'll have a look at that in the third part of the show. So let's start off by introducing everyone. Hello, good evening, Neil. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, really good. Been out with the camera today, but for a bit of a walk. Weather's good. Leaves are turning. Yeah.
Good, good. Damien, how are you?
Very good. I had a great time. We have a local Instagram group that goes around various places, and we went into the old municipal bank in Birmingham, which is now owned by the University of Birmingham, and we had some fantastic shots of all the safety deposit boxes and various things like that. So had a good time doing that.
Did you find anything in them?
Well, nothing in them. I mean, they've all been scattered around the building. I'm going to do a blog on it eventually and get it out there. But one of them that was open said, you mustn't open it unless there was a little handwritten sticker on it. Can only be opened in the presence of a solicitor. They survived all this time.
Oh, dear. All right. And Ian, good evening. Ian, how are you?
Yeah, very well. Been out with a camera this afternoon shooting mushrooms. So
good.
Yeah.
We'll look forward to seeing.
I see Neil is surrounded by fungi.
I'm in my cave.
Yeah, any of them edible?
I don't know. I have no idea. There's a lot of edible, but yeah. Here in Switzerland, you can, if you pick a mushroom and you're not sure if it's edible, you go to the police station and ask somebody at the police station, they'll tell you whether it's edible or not.
I thought you were going to ask some policeman, you try that, could you eat that for us and see if it's all right?
They have an expert there.
And Neil, just like magic, they tell you.
Oh, magic mushrooms, eh? Oh, yeah.
They're legal as well.
Yeah, not part of my youth I want to go back to too quickly. Okay, so let's start off with the news items that we found over the last few weeks. The big news for us to talk about is our expert here, Neil. Neil has won a category in the, what's the name of the Pronatura?
Pronatura. They're a big environmental group in Switzerland. And so, they had a photography competition with the idea being pictures for wild mountains, forests, water, and urban environment. And I've won the urban environment.
Well done. Let me show the picture up here so everyone can see. There you go.
Did you win overall, Neil? Did you?
That category.
So just looking on the website, there's 349 images in that category. So
yeah,
that's an awesome achievement.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a very clever photograph. Was that luck, or did you see it happening? How did you just kind of?
I saw it start to happen. Basically, the lizard started to climb up this big concrete pylon just on the edge of the village. And I know it's got these two arrows because it's a marked path. And I just stood there for a minute going, go on, a bit further, well, up a bit. And then as soon as he was in between the arrows, I clicked away. But the funny thing is, he went up a little bit more, then fell off.
Yeah, it's almost like, yeah, it's sort of like some of these people who feed an onion to their little baby to get a reaction, don't they? You're prodding it with the stick. Go on, up a bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, what you can't see in the shot is Neil's got a monopod at the bottom and he's poking
it
up.
Bashing it all.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, Neil. It's always nice to see win something like when you enter.
And I won something Nikon as well. So
you couldn't. If they'd been Canon binoculars, I suppose you would have really had to suffer for your art, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would have done. Yeah,
it's good fun doing the competitions and pushing forward. I think that it's really good. I mean, Ian, you got shortlisted again on the weekly. So I have with your mushrooms,
you know,
or your button mushrooms on the share Mondays.
Oh, I missed that. Did I? Oh, thank you.
You see that? You got on the Share Mondays. London.
Did I? Oh, no, yeah. I missed that.
Okay, I'll show the link up here and people can go and have a look.
I'm always looking out for everybody. So
I didn't get any further with the close-up photographer of the year, unfortunately.
Didn't you?
But to get shortlisted was nice. So yes, yeah. I'll take that.
I must put that one down for next year. Not that, you know, I stand much chance, but I forgot about that one coming up.
Good, well done.
There's a number of competitions. There's a campaign by the time, there's something called Britain Campaign or Campaign Britain, where they're wanting to take pictures and put them in Heathrow Airport, and you get a £500 licence fee. I can put that around the group if need be. But it's going to end at the end of
October. Yeah, we'll put the link up.
Yeah, drop it in.
Excellent. Okay. Moving on. There was an article that you saw, Damo, about this missing camera. Let me show it up here. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, it was somebody had lost his camera for 12 years on a walk up somewhere up north, I think it was Scotland, and someone had found it. And it still had this, it was able to identify it because the person had had put the name and address in on a picture on the card. And it reminds me of in 2012 in September when I had my my Canon G12 with me, and I was on the train up to the university, and I'd left it on the seat, and I got off the train to go to the university, and I thought, oh, I've left my camera on the seat, shop with the doors closed, and then I managed to get hold of Selly Oak station. But by the time they searched the train at Selly Oak, the next one, someone had obviously seen it and taken it. And so that rang true to me. We lose all sorts of things. I mean, when I was taking that picture of the fungus, my tripod disintegrated on me. My central pole of the Manfrotto disintegrated. I think I'd yanked it too much. And then two little bits fell into the leaves. So I was looking around and I hadn't got a clue what I'd lost or whatever. Luckily, when I got back home, I found I'd retrieved all the right bits and was able to put it back together. So I know a bit about how tripod central poles are put together. So it's sort of, you know, we all lose things like lens caps and stuff, and put them in our pockets or put them down then go off. I mean, every photographer losing, but losing a camera is the ultimate, I think. And that's why it just rang to me. It was a nice, happy story.
Well, it's a good idea to put a label on the memory card.
Yeah.
I mean, if someone finds it and they just decide, oh, I'm going to keep the camera, you know, but at least they might just think, oh, maybe I'll just post this memory card back anonymously.
But there's a wider issue about that. How do you ever mark your equipment? Do you ever put like your postcode on it or your name or a number? Do you take photographs of your kit so that you can actually identify it? Serial numbers. Have anyone listed their serial numbers for their kit?
So I register all my kit on Nikon's website. So if I want a list of what I've got, I can go on there and it shows me everything, whether it's in warranty or not.
Right.
So they know what I have.
Canon do something similar. I've got all my Canon equipment lodged with them and all the serial numbers. So if it was lost and someone actually brought it into a service centre, there's a chance that the serial number would flag up as stolen. But as I said, I don't know whether it's an idea to actually get one of these little marker pens, or not marker pens, but marker blades, and actually scratch your postcode or something on the camera.
Second-hand value goes down if you
put it inside a door or something like that where it's not visible.
Probably the best thing to do is to stick a label on the battery.
Yeah.
Or on the memory card.
Yeah, that can easily be thrown away. I remember in the old days, it can, but
you know, someone you could scratch a number on and somebody could scratch it off. They could put something over it. You know, there's 101 things you could do.
You put it on a
door, you can actually just change the door.
Yeah. I think in this instance he'd actually taken a picture of his address, hadn't he? And the picture was on the memory card.
Yeah.
Which I've never thought of doing.
Doing it since I lost my the G12, and there's lots of sites out there you can put your lost camera on, and people do come back at you and chat to you, but it's a real needle in the haystack.
Yeah, you'd have to remember to add that photo every time, because I mean, once I've taken the images off the card, I'd format the card.
Same here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the most I've done is I've got a notes file that I've listed all my equipment, serial numbers, and sort of retail prices that I paid at the time, but for insurance reasons, really, because I do have cover for my gear. You know, and if my car got broken into, my camera bag got stolen, I'd like to have an idea of what I'd be claiming for.
Do you keep that list firmly hidden from the wife, Ian?
Yeah, it's quite, actually, when I did it, because I did it not scary. That long ago, it's scary because I listed everything from, you know, light stands to soft boxes, just out of interest. And yeah, it's quite scary how much I've accumulated.
Do you remember the time when we used to use film? I was always advised to put your postcode inside the lens cap on Tippex, and then the first photograph you took of a film was that inside the lens. So if the film got separated from your address at bonus print, they could look and find out. Oh, okay, and there was a phone number or your postcode. So that's a while back, bonus print.
It's just a lesson. I just enjoy the story because I've been through losing a camera before. And I just thought it just a sort of a timely reminder, as we all know, to everybody out there.
They didn't mention the camera, did they? Just that they could retrieve the images, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes you wonder. I mean, I think on my Canon, the most you can do is put like a copyright name into the actual camera, can't you?
Yeah.
Because it makes you
think that there's not maybe an opportunity there for manufacturers where you could put a full name, address of the owner in the camera.
Even if it's just a phone number.
Is that the information that's put onto every photograph that's taken on the camera?
Yeah.
It might be an idea.
There's room enough to put a phone number in there, I think, on with the Nikons anyway.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess you could do, instead of the copyright info, you could just put a number in there, I guess, couldn't you?
I think there's enough characters, depending on the length. There's something like 40 characters on the Nikon, I think.
Okay. Well, there's something we'll have a look at for the next show.
That's a good idea.
Okay. The other item that you spotted, Damo, that you mentioned, was this this potential loss that Nikon have made or... Is it a mischievous post? I'll show it up here from Digital Camera World.
It was reported on their website and also an amateur photographer, and they were talking about that the Nikon are still producing all their Z mount and lenses and et cetera, but they were saying they had sort of profit losses. And it seems to be a story that keeps doing the rounds, yet are they trying to, as you say, is it a sort of a story that's trying to do Nikon down, or is it something more that's going to happen to all manufacturers? I just don't know. But I mean, those seeds of doubt don't really help a great deal.
Well, we've talked about this over the last year or the shows we've been on about how hard a time most of the camera manufacturers are having, certainly with the lockdown. And yet, as you say, they're all still steaming ahead with new kit, new models, both the two big ones have launched new mounts, haven't they, in the last few years?
I mean, it might be just for the factor of the pandemic and the shipping problems. If you buy anything new, you're going to get it in time.
I was going to say it's a bit of a double whammy, isn't it? Because there's definitely big demand out there for Nikon's ZFC, isn't there? So, but you can't sell it if you haven't got it. So, you know, there is an element of that as well, isn't there?
And some of the lenses they announced with that are still not shipping.
Yeah. Well, so you can't make money if you can't sell it, can you?
And is there a problem that this global shortage of small chips, because a lot of the lenses now actually have chips in them, don't they, to help with the control and everything. So I don't know whether that's having an effect, that they're not able to get the components they need to produce in the numbers to sell quickly. But you've kind of got $262 million losses, but then these companies are turning over billions of dollars. So is that a figure that they can carry for a few years until they get back to profitable levels?
They said they've written off $262 million in impairment losses. I don't know what that means. But they said they did lay off sort of 2,000 employees during the last financial year as well. So
I think also transferred their manufacturing from Japan to is it Thailand, I think, where they're already manufacturing stuff, but they've moved all the manufacturing now. So I guess that's part of a restructuring and cost saving process.
I presume it's cheaper labour costs than homegrown. Yeah.
Another thing I thought was an interesting statement in there is they're going to maintain their focus on mid to high end products for professionals and hobbyists, which I think is fairly obvious. But basically, it's saying that there's little point in going at the low end compact sort of market with smartphones and stuff. So that seems like a sensible thing, but it's a smaller part of the pie potentially, isn't it?
Right, okay, guys. So, yeah, we'll have to keep an eye on that to see what's happening with Nikon. And I said it'd be interesting to see if Canon sort of have to end up going down the same route. Right, now, one thing I wanted to bring up, I found this website. It's called, it's from mymodnet.com, and it's all about capturing day and night photographs in New York. This photographer, his name's Stephen Wilkes, seems to specialise in this. And if you have a look on the website here, pop out and see them. So his photographs basically show a picture of a famous New York or Washington landmark. And then it shows the progression of the day from dawn to dusk. It seems to be quite a clever concept. And the photographs themselves are pretty, some of them are very interesting. The one that caught my attention was they have at the moment with the Washington Monument, the big spike. They've got a monument there to all the COVID victims. 645,000 Americans have died, and each one they've put a little white flag on the grass there. And when you look at it like that, when it's laid out in that kind of proportion, it sort of brings it home about how devastating this has been. But the pictures themselves, as I said, it just shows that transgression from dawn over to dusk and night, and they're very clever. He goes into, if you follow the article and goes to his website, he does go give into details of how he gets these photographs taken, and apparently it takes him up to 30 hours to get one of these shots. So I presume he's taking the same shot, you know, every 10 or 15 minutes, and then somehow using software to integrate them all the way through.
Yes, they're very clever. I mean, as a one look, they are very clever. But goodness me, it's taken a long time. The yellow taxis one is very good.
Yeah,
Times Square is pretty cool.
Yes.
And what's the other one? Is it the Flatiron building?
That's cool, because he's used the building itself to split day and night.
Yes, that's very clever.
Very impressive. So yeah, have a look at that. As I said, I think some of the photographs are well worth looking over.
Yeah, I should imagine that takes some serious process and some manual sort of post processing involved as well, I think.
But you've done similar to that with some of your night shots, haven't you, Ian? Where you've taken a whole raft of shots to get your nighttime photographs, and what do you stitch them together and then produce.
Yeah, I mean, the Star Trail stuff is quite, I mean, you can get software for that. I mean, that's quite an automated process. I mean, sometimes I'll blend, you know, a foreground exposure with a night sky exposure, but that's, if you haven't got anything too complicated in the foreground, that can be quite an easy sort of, you know, just mask it in Photoshop. But these, you know, it's got buildings breaking the horizon line, and you can just see there's some clever sort of
graduated. Sort of, it's almost like a graduated filter over, I don't know how many images it would be, but it must be a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, but I don't think it's as simple as, if you look at that, like the Flatiron one, I don't think it's as simple as going, like the right-hand side is night and the left-hand side is day, because if you look at the right-hand side one, to me, the buildings look a mixture of day and night. They're not completely, like you'd expect those buildings otherwise to be quite dark and the window light to be brighter. So I think there's some really clever blending going on there, I think.
And the with the sky as well, because it seems there's not because you imagine the clouds moving.
Yeah.
You would either end up with a completely white sky or it would just be blurred.
I mean, there's one surety there. Those will sell to people in that area.
Oh, yeah.
People will buy them.
It's not something you can go out and do yourself, is it, that easy? Because, oh, I'll go and get that picture. But
just to leave a camera in one place for so long is, you know, that in itself is a feat for security, if nothing else.
I suppose he has to sit there with it the whole time.
I was going to say, I think he'd have to be there to manage the exposure between shots.
Yeah. Have a look at that and tell us what you think. Okay, that's the news items we found this week. So tonight we're going to look at a few pieces of gear that we've spotted. Neil, did you have a chance to look at the stuff we found at the Nikon Center? We made a little video for you last week.
Yeah.
Couldn't get here. So I thought that you might enjoy that.
Thank you for that.
Playing around with the Nikon ZFC, was it?
The FC, yeah.
Yeah.
A nice camera, yes. It's something I would be happy if it fell in my lap and picked up and...
Let's see what we can find this week. So we've started a quest for Damo to find a tripod. He's going away on holiday, and he asked us about a travel tripod. So far we've said don't bother buy one when you're out there and then throw it away. Or we started to look around to see what is option. Now you found one. Is it a Kickstarter project?
Yeah, it's a Kickstarter. It's called Viewpoint. It's the ultralight tripod. Yeah. They say it's 255 grams, about the same as a phone. So it's super, super light. I think it's only rated to about 4 kilos.
Right.
So you're not going to be putting anything much on there. And from the video I saw, it does look a bit flimsy.
What's it made of? Carbon fiber or...?
It'll be carbon fiber, yeah.
So it's strong.
There's some sort of twist lock legs, almost similar to the sort of thing we use with ski poles.
Right.
So that you untwist the pole from inside it and pull it out and then twist it back to lock it. Yeah. If it's anything like ski poles and that, after a while they will jam.
I've got one on my shower. It holds the curtain up, and then all of a sudden you're having a shirt and collapses. So not the best.
It doesn't have a central pole. It just has the three. So and it looks quite good.
It's very, very light. It's small. It looks reasonably quick to put together. To put up. If you're just using a point and shoot, I think it'd be ideal.
Or a
phone.
Because the picture here, that looks, that's quite a large camera and lens on there.
I could put my Z6 and it's 24-70 on there. Oh. It's only just over a kilo, so.
You wouldn't wander far away from that one, would you, Ian?
Max recommended total weight, 3 kilograms. I mean, my 5D Mark III and the 24-70 2.8 would be 2 kilos. Right. But then it says max recommended lens weight, 1 kilogram.
Presumably so that's because it's got some sort of ball head on it and it'll tip down.
It won't lock.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to walk too far away from it.
No. But at least it'd be light to stick in your bag. You'd be able to carry that around.
It'd be pretty cool for, if you want to do stuff with smartphone or something. I mean,
and the one you mentioned last time, Ian, we looked at the Kingspan. Was that the Kingspan?
King Joy.
That looked quite good. I had a look at the chart on the site, and quite decent.
I don't venture too far away from it.
No. I would, if I was putting a large lens, I'd want something far more sturdy. But so we'll keep looking for ideas for you, Damien. We'll find something for you to use. And of course, then when you do buy it and you take it, we're going to have to get a review from you as to what you found and how it worked. Okay. So again, coming back to you again, Neil. It seems to be all you tonight. You're saying about the release date possibly of the Z9.
So
the lenses you looked at. Let me show
so
you.
Nikon's new flagship camera, the Z9 mirrorless. There's been two teaser videos out in the last 2 weeks. One was from a safari shoot where somebody gets off the van, gets down and looks like they've got some sort of zoom lens, something that's, it's bigger than a 7200, but it's probably not something like the 200, 600 they're promising. So it may be the 100, 400 that's been rumored. But it was a Z mount lens. They also did a video where they were talking about the 8K video and how it seems to have an endless file size. So you could just continually record. There is no limit on the actual file size you're recording. I don't know how that's done. It must be recording to an external device somehow. But it's interesting now. We're starting to see a lot of it. It's got the screen on the back of it. When you turn the camera, the image will rotate with it and the screen folds out in both dimensions. So it'll flip out in landscape. It'll flip out in landscape mode. But when you turn the camera effectively to portrait, it'll flip out in portrait as well. And the image will rotate on the back of the camera. So that's pretty cool.
Doesn't it tilt down as well?
It'll tilt from the back of the camera. It will tilt out and up or back down.
So if you want to hold it up like that, then you could tilt it down.
But if you turn the camera as well, it tilts out the other way. So it'll tip out 90 degrees. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever do it. You put your camera in portrait and you put it low to the ground, but the screen on the back doesn't tilt the way you want it to tilt. You know, you want it to tilt effectively left to right, and it doesn't. It looks like this does, okay. Which is pretty cool. So this is the other thing. There was a link. It was actually to a Swiss website, brack.ch. Although I see the price has now disappeared. It was up there at around about just over sort of £7,500 with the exchange rate. So that was quite interesting, but it's just a ballpark figure that they put on. You couldn't order it or anything.
But
the fact that it's leaked out from a website, a commercial website, you kind of think it must be coming. It must be nearly there.
Is this a kind of Nikon spoiler for Canon's R3? Are they trying to think, you know, don't immediately buy your R3, look at what we've got to offer.
Yeah, there's talk of 30 frames a second, 8K video. Hopefully, you know, you won't need an extra fan on the back, like the Canons.
Yeah, water cooling. Yes, new
thing. Yeah, and what was the other spec? Oh, it's got this new type sensor. It's some sort of...
It's a stack sensor, isn't it?
That's it, yeah. Stack sensor as well. But there's anything from... £6,000 to £8,000 has been rumoured. So, okay. Who knows?
To your question though, Martin, I'd say I don't think if you're in the Canon world, I don't think this tempts you to go to Nikon, or vice versa. This is just Nikon appealing to their pro level photographers.
Is it to keep them in the fold? You know, because
they've got to do it, haven't they? You know, Sony have got their A1. Canon are going to have their R3 and Nikon need their, Z9.
We've talked about it before. It's the issue is anybody who's into their photography, the money is in the lenses. The bodies come and go, but the lenses are there for forever. You know, one of the things with Nikon is with the F mount, you can use the F mount on the Z mount as we've got, and the F mount's been there since, I think, the 80s. So you can literally pick up any of the old lenses and mount them on a current body. And I've got a 20mm manual focus lens that's from 2000. It's 20 years old, and it works beautifully on the Z mount.
There also is an increasing facility now for hiring equipment and lenses and cameras and all that sort of stuff. So that might be where you could possibly think about switching from one manufacturer to another if your preference is for hiring equipment.
It's a big, costly move to do that. You'd have to have a really good reason.
It's a big jump, a really big jump. You're locked in once you're in then.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. I mean, this camera's not aimed at any of us.
No.
You know, and it's the same with
the R3. I wouldn't say
no. Oh, yeah, but if I had the money, then yeah. But
yeah.
I wouldn't scratch the surface on an R3, and I wouldn't scratch the surface on... It'd be a waste of money for me because I wouldn't use... I wouldn't push it to anywhere near its capability.
And I'm going to take that conversation up a bit when I look at the Canon lenses, Ian, because I'm starting to think, you know, is an R5 what you need? Is an R6 going to be more suitable to swap some of my stuff in to get the R6?
Yeah, the only thing that puts me off the R6, because I really do like the top plate screen on the cameras. I do use it. I use it a lot to change my settings. And the R6 doesn't have that. The R5 does. And then there is the sort of the big megapixel difference between the R6 and the R5. I mean,
those are the two things. You're probably taking my conversation away from me already now.
Yeah. I can help you spend your money.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we need that big lottery win on Tuesday to get this kind of kit. Because then you could buy both, couldn't you? You could have a Nikon one hand and a Canon the other.
You could...
And then just for the weekend, you could take the Sony out, couldn't you, if that's what you wanted to do?
No. Yeah. I'd go Leica.
You wouldn't go Hasselblad.
Oh, we're Hasselblad, yeah.
Yeah. Well, now we
anyway, what you got to remember is,
aren't you?
You know, with these Z9s and that, you've got to have two because you need to have a backup camera.
Yeah. and one to lend to you, Ian. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, of course, even just one as a test kit, we'd be very happy to get.
I'd love to try it out.
Just send it one. We'll share it around the four of us. We'll give you a really good review on what we find. So, yeah, so just think about that, guys. Send us the latest unit. We'd be more than happy to do a review.
I'd be really interested to see what it's like actually shooting stuff like sport. I do a lot of sport stuff and... Mm. So the fast frame rate is really handy because you're so easy to miss. But the other thing you need is quick focus.
Yeah, is there anything rumored around that? Because the R3, the motorsport stuff seems to be like really impressive, and everyone that's sort of tried it says it is.
It's meant to be. There's no real details, but they are talking about the best that's ever been. To compete with the R3, and push those boundaries. So that they're talking about it, but what it does or not, we don't know. It's too early.
But when you get up to, you're talking about 30 frames a second rate. That's video quality. That's
what I think.
Your frame rate is 29.6, I believe. So you're
I think they're using the video to do it. So they're talking 30 frames a second, but they're not saying what the images would be. So it could be that they are just using the 8K video.
I was going to say, so you don't think it'll be 30 frames at full raw size then?
No, I don't think so.
Well, the R3's doing, 20 at full raw, isn't it? So it's not...
Yeah. So I don't know. It may be they're playing with specs. You know what these companies do? We can do 30 frames a second, but they don't tell you what the resolution is because you really just want to, a lot of people want to read the tech specs.
But if you're shooting at a 60th of a second, how could you do 30 frames a second? The shutter would be operating slower than the frame rate.
We can't.
You'd have to be above a 30th of a second speed-wise. So, yeah, okay. Millie, you wouldn't really be taking 30 frames a second of, slow speed like that. So, all fun. Okay, let's move on. Now, you mentioned it there, a nice little segue there. Neil, about lighting and Damo's favourite light, the Roto light, which he had some strong words to say about last time. So you found another one. What's this? The Neo 3 and the Aero EOS 2, is it?
Yeah. I stuck this in just to to prod demo a little bit, to be honest.
Well, I quite like my light over, and I've got my Neo light out here at the moment. It's quite good. It does, it's an LED light, doesn't get hot. It's got some nice lighting to it. This Neo 3 is supposedly all singing, all dancing, much more powerful, gives a better light to it. It's just an upgraded version. But what was interesting, we were chatting earlier, is about, it's a Kickstarter project as well that they put together on. Yeah. Which, Neil, you think was a way of just sort of making you absolutely sure you're going to sell the thing before you launch it?
It's common sense, really, I guess, in a way, and actually good business. If you can make something and guarantee 1,000 orders before you do, so you cover your costs,
yeah, and you've got the
money up front to develop it, why not?
Yeah, their goal was only £15,000, which is peanuts, isn't it, in the scheme of things. For a company that size, so I think there's an element of sort of marketing involved as well by getting it on Kickstarter. I mean, they've got a table on there, a comparison chart. I mean, it does look, compared to the Neo 2, I mean, it does look like quite an impressive upgrade. The bit I find is interesting is digital filters, 2,500 digital filters, and I interpret that as different colours that you can set it, different gels. Which is quite cool. But peak brightness, 4,541 lux versus 1,600 on the Neo 2. So, I mean,
it's going to blind you.
Everything, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big leap from the Neo 2.
Well, so far, according to the site, they've raised £226,000 as opposed to the $15,000 goal. So, that's not a small bit of money if that's come through.
So what do you have, Damo? Do you have the Neo 2?
No, I've got the Neo 2, yeah. I think I've got the Neo 2. I can't see because I've got everything dark here at the moment.
What do you use it for then, other than light and zoom?
It's my general light is the light I use. I'm debating whether to get a softbox or anything else like that. But it's for doing this sort of thing, it's very good for lighting. I use it the lighting for the macro photography, if I'm doing it for the oil and water. It's just a good general purpose light, and it doesn't get hot, so, and it's all sealed, so to an extent I can move it around the place, and it's
they're always at the photography show, I noticed, but it's not a stand over lookout, because continuous lighting I've never really gotten into in any big way, but I mean, they do look nice units, to be fair.
You can put them on top of the camera and use it as on the show, or off lighting as well, but I say it's not a flash, but it gives a very nice result.
This one's a flash as well.
Have they got flash on it?
It does high speed sync flash, which I find confusing for a continuous light. But
okay. So while we're on the subject of the new kit, we were looking at some different types of lenses. Two in particular stand out. You spotted a new Canon lens, Damien, and Neil, you spotted a new Sony lens, was it, that you were saying?
Yes, Sony have redone their 7200.
I think you said earlier, Martin.
The lightest.
Yeah.
You said, Martin, earlier, or was it you, Neil, saying that the mounts have not changed all that time, but all these new cameras are now coming out with the... and they've all got lenses to attach to them. So whether you just buy a little attachment so you can put your old lenses onto it. But it seems that the optics are getting better and better. I just saw a review of a macro lens, of the 100mm macro lens, and they're giving it 5 stars. They say the optics are superb. And not only are the attachments changing, but the optics are getting better and better.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that mirrorless offers is the ability to make smaller lenses equivalent, don't they? But I guess by making the glass smaller, I don't know if optically that makes it easier, if that makes sense. If you're dealing with, I don't know, I'm not an expert.
The other thing is, certainly the Z mount on Nikon is a larger aperture. Larger flange. So that you have the ability to let more light in the first place.
That's how they can make the the mirrorless lens is smaller because you
well, they've not made them much smaller yet. That's the interesting part.
Well, lighter, certainly lighter. I mean, those two, and the optics that they got of these two are really wide. One of them's a wide-angled lens, and the other one's the 100 to 400. And I've got the 100 to 400 myself, and it's a heavy beast. And that one looks much more compact.
Yes, yeah, so maybe they're putting less element in them, or they can use smaller elements.
Surely, if the mount is actually larger, allowing more light into the sensor, then you don't need as large a lens, diameter of a lens, to get the same amount of light.
That was my thought process.
Yeah, you get the diameter of these lenses seems to have shrunk a bit, and they don't seem to be as long as they are. I was looking at the new 7200 from Canon, and it's definitely smaller than the old 2.8.
I mean, to Neil's point, yeah, some of the lenses haven't got smaller, but I think on the flip side, I think I can't think Canon do like so in the digital SLR range, they do like is it like 16 to 35 or something, and it'll be like a f2.8, whereas in the, and don't quote me on that because I don't think that's exactly right, but in the mirrorless version it'd be a 16 to 35, but they managed to do it at f2.
Yeah,
so not any smaller, but you're getting a faster lens in theory, so they're taking advantage of that larger flange. So mirrorless has given them options to do stuff differently to what they were doing, and that's why they released that, you know, that 600 and 800 mil f11 and stuff like that. They're really doing stuff different to what they were doing with the digital SLR lenses, which is quite intriguing.
I think also there's a bit, if you've got a very good 7200, you're not likely to change it. If they bring out a new lens, which is maybe 50 to 250, which is roughly the same size, you might be more tempted to buy that than just sticking with your old one.
There's a lens that I've had my arm for a while, and I was going to buy it when we were going traveling last year. And there's a 24-200 on the Z mounts, and it's a fantastic lens.
Yeah,
and
that's the one I was just going to mention.
Yeah,
there's a couple of Nikon photographers I follow on YouTube, and typically those ultra zoom lenses are not that great. The super zoom range, because they're normally sort of pretty soft at either end, and they're okay in the middle sort of thing. Yeah. But those photographers, they rave about that lens.
Yeah, the sharpness of the lenses is very impressive.
Yeah. Mm. But then they run higher apertures, don't they? 4.5 to 5.3.
That one. The interesting, that one's, something like that. It might even be 6.3
yeah,
at the top end.
But if you want
if you're doing landscapes.
Yeah. Mm. Or if you're like also, me, you've been lazy and you want to travel with just one lens, you can stick that on the camera and practically do most of what you want to do. So.
But also, I think the aperture, okay, if you want a particularly shallow depth of field effect, then obviously, you know, f5.6, 6.3 is not going to be great, but typically these newer cameras are really great at higher ISOs, so you can get away with not having such a fast lens because the cameras are handling the noise so much better.
Yeah, I mean, I know my D750, which I guess is probably 10 years old design wise, I won't use the ISO above 1600 on that. It'll go a lot higher. But with the Nikon, or with the Z I've got, the Z6 I've got, I'll happily use 3200. Happily.
Mm. I think it might be worthwhile trying to get a lens expert to come along and tell us all about this stuff and how it's changing and where we should be looking at buying our new lenses. Okay, let's move on. That's the new kit, new gear that we found in the last few weeks. So tonight's topic is going to be about macro photography, another specialised part of photography that maybe some of us haven't tried in the past or would like to have a look at. So I'm going to get the guys here to tell us a little bit about macro photography, what they do and how it's been done. I think last year we used it with the bubble photography. Was that part of that? So yeah. So skip the ball off, Ryan. Ian, what's your views on macro photography and how do you go about it?
I think it just opens up another world with macro. You know, you look at something like that, you know, those mushrooms behind Neil, and they look interesting like that. But when you start really going in, you see things that you didn't see when you're looking at them at that sort of size, if you see what I mean. That's what I find fascinating about macro. And it doesn't have to be, I mean, we'll talk a little bit about some of the gear you need. Obviously a macro lens is handy, but I've done loads of macro over the years with just, you know, 50 mil, you know, the nifty 50 mil 1.8 and some extension tubes. You can get some great results just to start off with. So
explain what is macro. So you're talking about detailed close photographs up close to the object. So you're talking about maybe being within what, a few inches of the actual object?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, true macro is what, you know, one to one reproduction ratio, isn't it? So I don't know if I was taking a picture of my AirPod, it's representing it exactly the same size on the sensor, if that makes sense. True one-to-one size. That's when you're getting into true sort of macro.
That you need specialized lenses to do that. You can't just, I think one of my lenses has got, it says macro on the end of it. So if I just turn it to that position, does it mean I can
not get necessarily, that kind of thing? No. Under the true macro, one-to-one is normally considered proper macro, if you like. But as I say, you can get pretty close with extension tubes. It's a good way to start, or reversing. I've not tried it myself, but you can buy reversing rings. So you take a lens, you put a ring on the filter thread, and on the other side of the ring, it's got the mount for your camera. So you reverse the lens and you mount it onto the camera backwards. But that enables, because you reverse the elements, that enables you get crazy close to your subject and magnify it. I did that once
with snowflakes. And that's just really cool for doing that. Yeah. It's very difficult to position the lens to the right distance because the depth of field is so shallow.
Yeah.
But it is incredible. It's like looking at, you know, stuff under a microscope then. It really is.
So I know it's not photography, it's more of it. So when you watch these videos, Apple in particular, when they're showing you iPods or a phone, and the whole phone corner of them fills up the whole screen, is that, that's kind of like macro photography in the video world, is it? That they're zooming in so tight, or is most of that these days digital photography? It's not even a real object they're filming.
I think you just got to think about some of the phones are distorting. I mean, it was interesting on BTN, they started saying, someone had used the phone and said that it's good macro, I can really see everything with the lens. I mean, I sort of grew up with macro with a ring flash. I bought my own ring flash, a Canon 500D, and used it to take pictures of people's teeth and intraoral stuff. I was just religiously stayed on the settings of a focus, f22, a shutter speed of 200, ISO 100, and that was the setting you used for all the macro settings for your ring flash. So whenever I reach for my macro, I'm always going to those settings to get that, and then I use 100 f. I've got one without the ring flash. I've got one that I can use with a ring flash with the f2.1. And so, but then I found it really difficult coming away from dental photography where the ring flash did everything for you and you've got some really good pictures of the teeth, you know, where your mirrors were and you did reflections and everything. But then when you come on to animals and wildlife and everything like that, nature just takes over. It becomes very difficult because then you have to rely on the wind knocking the flower, the depth of field is really a little bit more difficult. And I do a lot of manual focus, so I move in and out that way to take the picture and that way. Although some people say you should use a tripod, and I like the flowers, but then insects and the dragonflies are much more difficult. And then when I find the long lenses, the 200 meter one, quite quite good because you can get some good macro shots doing it that way, and you can be a long way away from. And you two guys, Neil and Ian, are much better than that, and I'm sort of catching up with you from that point of view.
And I don't even own a macro lens.
You didn't what, sorry?
I don't own a macro lens. That's the funny part.
Yeah.
So I've been using tubes.
Yeah.
It's just extension tubes. It's a bit suck it and see. You can work out what the focal distance will be depending on the size of the tube, whether you're using, you know, a large one like that or a small one like that.
And you have a meter lens on it?
Well, I've used it with my 7200, which unfortunately is a Nikon repair at the moment. But I've used it with that, and I've usually set it to around about 100 mil. Yeah. But the only thing we use in a tube is you're adding more connections. So there's a possibility of getting a bad connection between the lens and the body of the camera. So I found when we were doing the bubble photography, using the Z6 with the Z to F adapter, then the extension tube, then the lens, the actual lens itself, if I was shooting directly down above something, occasionally I'd get a bad connection because of all the different pieces connected together.
Another drawback with extension tubes, you know, something to bear in mind is essentially you're moving the lens away from the sensor.
Yeah.
So, you know, the lens is designed to, you know, bring your red, green, blue rays of light together at a point onto the sensor. So if you suddenly move that point away, you're potentially scattering the light. So you could then
affect
your image quality. So it's just something to bear in mind.
I quite like my 100 F2 lens. I really enjoy using that for the macro. I know my way around it and that. And I find then the big problem is making sure I get the lighting. So I've read a lot of macro photographers in the wildlife photographers, and they're using not using the ring flash, but using different lighting, directional lighting or lighting coming from two sides. And that, I think, is very much the art of it, getting your lighting right.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, if somebody wants to get into the macro or just try it, experiment with it, then tubes is a cheap way to do it. That or try and pick it up a second-hand lens.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. I mean, I use a Sigma 105 f2.8, one of the original, you know, it's not got, you know, hyper-focus focusing or image stabilization or anything like that, but I got it for 99 quid in a cash generator, and the autofocus is a bit hit and miss, but I don't use autofocus when I'm doing macro because I'm like Damo, most of the time I'm manual focus, and I will just, if I'm not working off a tripod, I will just gently rock. Because yeah, you can move like 1 millimeter, and that's a massive amount when you're looking through the viewfinder because you're working at such shallow depths of field. But that lens is tack sharp. I mean, the shots that you're going to show shortly, Martin, are all taken with that lens. It's that lens was a bit of a saviour through lockdown for me. I did all the bubbles, the oil, some dandelion shots. They all came out of that lens. It was my bargain buy, that one.
And you know, the other thing with a good macro lens like that Sigma you're talking about is I went on a walk into Birmingham and I thought I'd picked up the right lens. And I thought, oh my goodness, I got my macro lens. But actually, I started taking pictures of the macro lens and I got some really good telephoto lens effects with it at distance. And I was quite, you know.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a focal length. Yeah. So it just because it's touted a macro lens, I mean, 105 mil is not is a pretty good distance for portraiture photography, because you're not distorting the person too much. But as a walk around lens, you know, if you want a slightly different perspective, nothing wrong with using a macro lens.
It just forced me to rethink and. I rethought and thought it was quite good. But no, yes, I think macro is really good. But then it's also the timing, getting up early, making sure these animals are basically asleep in the water or whatever, with dew all over, or the butterflies. I've still not caught a butterfly like you have, Ian, and sometimes the dragonfly shots are really good because you're thinking where they're going to turn up and come every so often.
So as part of this discussion, we asked the guys to do some macro photography, and the subject chosen was fungi. Neil's got one behind him, but it was some of the macro photographs. So what we're going to do now is show up a series of photographs, and I'm going to get the guys to talk through each one and tell us, you know, how and where they took it, what was involved in the lighting.
So, before we go, Martin, just a plug. If you buy this week's Amateur Photographer, it's all, I'm not a seller, but it's all about close-up. It's their close-up special. And there's a wonderful article about 30 common mistakes on macro and how to avoid them. Thinking you've got to go and travel, forgetting about the rules of composition, thinking you have to have an expensive macro lens, extension tubes, and making sure you do your research. Keep the study steady, maximizing your depth of field, making sure you put your animals in context. Don't be afraid of blur. There's some really nice little tips on it. Okay. Worth getting.
All right. So
I think they need to start sponsoring you, Amateur Photographer, because you plug them every week.
Yeah. I really like the magazine.
It is a good magazine. I like it.
But, yeah. That's right. I haven't read it in years, so maybe it's worthwhile. So the guys here have taken a few photographs. Damien, I'm going to show your one up first. This is, I thought it was like, what do they call, deadly nightshade or red cap that you don't go near, but what's it actually called?
A fly algaric.
Right.
So, and
it is poisonous.
Is it? That's why it's bright red, isn't it? You know.
What is interesting, about this time of the year, there's two photographers in the Birmingham area that come up, Verity Milligan, who we've had on our show. She always finds one straight away. And there's another guy called Jim Panda, who works for the Wildlife Trust. And he found a whole stack of them. Usually they're nice toadstools with a nice flat top to them. But I thought I'd go out to the local woods and see if I can find any mushrooms. And I was thinking I would not find that one. And I hadn't gone that far into the woods, and I was looking down. I think in our pre-chat we talked about just keeping your eyes open, and it was hiding. It was just there, stood there, and it, countless numbers of walkers had gone past and no one had seen it. So I got very excited and just took loads of pictures of it. But the thing about it is I love the red color of it, and I used my tripod quite a bit, and I think I did another story in itself that I expertly dismantled my tripod trying to set it so the center pole could come down, and in the end I just put the I just got my camera back and just put the macro lens with camera on it and then just shot straight at it that way. And I really got very excited about it. Then I started messing around and put some leaves around it, which Ian said made it look better, having the leaves there to give it a bit more size comparison of that. And then I did notice those two blemishes on the top, but I was just so excited to see that I found one of these red mushrooms that I just took the pictures. But then we had the discussion afterwards, should I have photoshopped those out and put, because I did a couple of other shots. I did a real good macro of them, and those little tufts are where all the spores come out, but I'd gone for the setting in the woodland rather than getting really close up to it. But it's just to say to people, just keep your eyes out, they do exist, they're not hiding anywhere.
I mean, as far as the blemishes go, it depends what your opinion is on wildlife or nature photography. You know, are you representing it as it was, or are you happy to turn it into art or whatever and take the blemishes out? The thing with fly agaric is it open, so that one will eventually, so they go that round shape, and then it will sort of open up like a sort of more flat top. But the blemishes, I mean, fly agaric, the difficulty with fly agaric is it tends to sort of get spoiled pretty quick. I think the slugs and snails and that get to it, So to find one in good condition is the challenge, because I think they got, you've got quite a short window of them emerging and getting a good shot before they start looking messy.
What was the lighting on that, Damien? Just as it was, you found it in
as it was. I did get my iPhone out and tried some light with it, but in fact, I've been there for so long, the sun actually crept in there, so I got a bit of sunlight on it.
Okay, excellent. Right, so Ian, we're going to have a look at the one you took. This looks like a three-headed mushroom.
I don't know what type it is, to be honest. It was the colour that attracted me. I mean, one thing you've got, you know, you've got to root around in the sort of the under the leaves and stuff to find fungi. It tends to grow in sort of, you know, decaying wood, decaying leaves, etc. So you've got to scramble around a bit sometimes to find it. And this was on the floor up my local patch up Carmarth. I guess they were about that high,
yeah.
So maybe a couple of inches high. And it was the fact that there was the three of them, and then there was the one in the background on what sort of, to me, sort of complemented it. One thing when it comes to sort of gear is, I mean, in the end, like Damo with his, I mean, I literally had to just put the camera down on the floor because I couldn't get the tripod low enough. But for that particular shot, it was a stacked shot as well. It was sort of six or seven shots to get the depth of field.
Yeah.
Because I wanted the background sort of thrown out of focus. So I think it was like f/5.6, and it just slowly turning the focus to get it sharp, get the mushrooms sharp front to back, but keep the background nice and blurry. It's just natural light.
Yeah. Excellent. And do you say, I presume you have to go slightly off the beaten track or off the walkways to really stand a chance of getting this stuff, or is it just still visible even?
Not necessarily. I think, as you say, I think a lot of people just walk by oblivious sometimes, don't they? So, yeah.
Do you think you've got to be respectful of the nature as well?
Yeah.
You know, if you are tempted to go off the beaten track, you've got to watch where you're walking. Because you could, you know, as Ian said, you've got to hunt around for them, but you could quite easily be standing on them. And that's a shame.
Right. Okay, Neil, you sent us two or three to look at. The one that we were talking about was this one here from the centre of the log, which was quite a capture. Is that, that's literally has grown out of the middle of the tree, is it?
Yeah, so they... that's the one where it's right in the center of the log. It's a big stack of logs that they cut at the beginning of the year, and I guess they're just laying there to dry. Probably they'll collect them next year. And as I was walking by, there was just a whole bunch with the mushrooms growing out of them. It just caught my eye, and cost me about another 10 or 15 minutes to the walk I was on. We're quite fortunate that in this area there seems to be a lot of mushrooms. The place I walked today, compared to last week, there was 100% more.
Yeah.
There. The floor was carpeted.
Yeah, have you had rain at all?
Okay.
Sorry. No, we've not had rain.
Oh, okay. Because I read that sort of the best time to find fungi is sort of like after rain, not immediately after rain, but like, you know, a couple of days after, because I guess the conditions of damp and, you know, the moisture and a bit
of warmth. But we've got a lot of cold weather, so we've got a lot of heavy dew in the mornings, and I guess then it's drying out, you get the warmth during the day at the moment. So we've got cold nights, warm days, and probably a 15 degrees temperature swing at the moment. So I don't know if that's why it's helping it.
Yeah.
But I think it's a case of once you start looking, you then know where they are. You start seeing them. I'm seeing them all the time, like you, Neil. I'm suddenly finding them in children's playground where my grandchildren are playing. I found them in my daughter. She hadn't cut the grass in the back. Her backyard's got the mushrooms growing up.
Yeah.
But you've got to stop somewhere with the amount of photographs I could take. But I'm going to go back now. Now I've seen your two pictures, I'm going to go back the next weekend now, or go into the forest and have a look.
Neil, another one of yours I'm going to show up here. This is a whole batch of them growing out of what the size? Is it a tree or is it a hedge?
It's a dead tree.
Right.
It's a dead tree on the side of a ditch. At some point, the top part of the tree is destroyed. And what's left of the tree is just moss. And as the bark comes off, the mushrooms seem to sort of climb up it. And the whole area is teeming with these tiny bunches of small mushrooms. I haven't looked up what they are yet.
What was that taken with, Neil?
That's a 2470 2.8, probably right. At something like 50 mil,
which is enough to throw the background there well out of focus. It's nice.
Yeah, that tree, I've been back to it twice over the last week, and every time I go back there's more. I thought they wouldn't last long, but they seem to be just coming more and more out of the tree.
Okay.
It's pretty cool.
And this one I'm going to show up here, Neil, it's not actually a macro, but it shows the extent of the mushrooms around a tree stump. It's a fair few there, isn't there?
I every time I walk up there now, I'm cursing. I haven't got a macro. I've forgotten I've got the extension tubes, to be honest. But I should be hunting for a cheap second-hand one.
And what time of day are these shots? Early morning?
No, late afternoon.
Right.
4 or 5 o'clock. These were taken.
Okay. And the last one I've got to show, Neil, is your wonderful picture here of a dragonfly.
That's a nice one, Matt. Yeah.
That's my lunchtime friend.
Okay. I presume that you didn't have a tripod set up and the fly was standing there waiting for you to take it.
He does hover in the same spot, but he's only ever there for a second or two.
Right.
So there's basically a bench sat next to a pond, which is full of reeds. And this dragonfly goes backwards and forwards over about a 4 or 5 meter stretch. And then every so often, another dragonfly will fly into his area. And he kind of chases them off, and he comes back and goes up and down again. I mean, the amount of energy they must use.
Yes.
It's incredible. But the amount of energy I think I used over 3 lunchtimes sitting there with a camera. And in fact, the best thing to do in the end, I found, was to manually focus. So it was a 7200 2.8 lens. I got it on manual focus. And I just had my finger on the focusing ring.
Just have it to the sort of
focused it on some grass that was sort of the same sort of distance of where he seemed to repeatedly kind of fly.
Yeah.
And then you just have to click off a few shots. And similar thing with Ian saying rocking backwards and forwards, I would just finger on the trigger. And as it did, I just rolled the focus ring a little bit.
Street photography for dragonflies.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's a case of hoping you got it right.
Yeah, no, it's a
southern hawker
shot. That's a cracking shot.
A southern hawker, is it?
A southern hawker. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So hopefully that's given you some ideas about taking some photography or macro shots. If there's any fungo around your way that you fancy sending some pictures in, please do. We're happy to show them up here in the gallery. It's a part of photography which some people specialise in, don't they? It becomes their whole focus. That's what they do, and they become experts in that field. But as I said, if you haven't tried it, it's something that we suggest you have a go at. And as I said, send us your results.
One thing that I wish for, though, having done this macro stuff later, is a flippy screen.
Oh, yes. The D5 doesn't have that.
I'm getting old and even today, I mean, I literally like crouched down right on the floor just to have a flippy screen would be, do my
makes
back
a huge
world
difference.
Again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you buy a mirror that you could put there just to do it? Yeah.
You can get like almost scopes that you could put on the viewfinder. I've got one.
Could you use your iPhone, Ian, to hold the iPhone?
My camera doesn't connect to my phone.
No, I mean, but just holding the phone near the back plate so you could be you know, you wouldn't have to get right down level with it. You could see
Something I picked up in a.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
So that just slots on the back, and then you just look straight down.
That's a good idea, actually.
Yeah.
And it actually, this one, one has a magnification as well. So you can magnify.
I can't. Trouble is, if I get one of those, I can't justify an R5 with a flippy screen, can I?
pick one of these up secondhand.
Yeah,
I want an R5.
it's a stopgap, Ian, to you know, while you're waiting for your R5.
Oh, that's a good shout, though, Neil. Well, I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, I ended up getting this one from Japan. This came all the way from Japan. It was only cost me £50.
Right.
And it even came with a nice letter from the person who sent it. It's in mint condition. You can swap and it'll magnify the image as well.
Yes, you have to get a specific one for your camera so it fits the slot. Yeah.
So that piece there has to be the right shape and size.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna look into that. It cost me money now.
If you find anything, let me know.
Yeah.
Is it stuck at the right angle? Does it
tilt? No, you can twist it.
Okay, but it doesn't go sort of from
5 degrees now.
I can do it. I can put it from sort of like
but it doesn't come towards you at all, does it?
No, it won't flip out. So no, you're always going to be looking at
it because it's got a mirror that I guess
it's a prism. Yeah, there's a prism inside it.
Yeah.
And you can you can adjust the focus on it as well. Yeah.
I'm gonna have to have a look at that.
There we go. Something for the next show. But,
if you do get one, adjust it before you go out.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll be down on your knees anyway, and then you'll be going, why did I bother?
Number of times I knock the diopter on my camera, and then I'll take it out of the bag or something and just catch it or something, and then I'll look through the view and think, well, why does that look blurry? And then I've knocked the diopter.
So on the Z6, you have to pull the diopter out to adjust it.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. Which is quite good.
Okay. So a quick mention to our sponsors, TSO Hosts, who provide all the services that we need to get these shows out to you all. They provide all the server bandwidth we need, as well as support for our systems. They're a great company to work with. I have my own site with them. And if you need anything to do with web design, domain names, hosting, anything like that at all, please contact them. And if you mention BTN20, they'll even give you a big discount off your first orders. Our other main sponsor here is IMN Max here in Birmingham, who are able to service and repair and upgrade any Apple kit or Apple machines that you've got, and they can even provide some really good refurbished machines with excellent value for money. And they deal with any kind of problem, actually. That's a nice bunch of guys. Just give them a ring if you have an issue, anything to do with your Macs, and I'm sure they can help you out.
Okay, so thanks very much, guys, for a very interesting show, and I'm sure you've given all our viewers some ideas about what they might be doing for the next few weeks with photography. So let's go around the board. Neil, how can we get hold of you, and where are you?
Well, I'm in Switzerland. You can find me at dodzyphoto.ch or dodzyphoto on Instagram.
Okay, lovely. And Damien, where can we get hold of you?
Well, Damo on the Instagram, Damo on Twitter, and then I've got my own page, DamienWormsley.com.
Okay, lovely. And Ian?
Yeah, ianlewisphoto.co.uk.
Okay, great. And you did there was a very good blog on your last blog was quite interesting, Ian.
Is that my walk, was it?
Yeah. It's a good read. Okay, stuff. And you can get hold of me at martinkelly@mac.com or Magic Man in the Slack room. Slack room is part of the BTN network. If you'd like to join that, there'll be a link here. Just send an email and you can come along and join us in the Slack room where we have our discussions. So for our next show, we're looking forward to having a guest with us. His name's Jeff Cable. He's a sports photographer. And he's done some outstanding work covering both the Olympics and the Paralympics. So he's come along to join us, talk about his work and show us some of the photographs he took. I believe he's an award-winning photographer, so that might be well worth your time to come along and see what he's got to say. Okay, see you on the next show. Good night, all. Bye. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.